Hello, and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are hundreds more of these conversations that you can get free of charge and with no ads because we're the ABC. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or just go to iTunes and search for Conversations with Richard Feidler. And while you're there, you can subscribe to this program if you like and have a conversation delivered to you every weekday automatically. It's easy.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. David Sedaris became a best-selling author after reading his famous Santaland Diaries on public radio in the US. And they recounted his experience working as an elf in Macy's department store in New York. Yes, an elf. Since then, his very candid and extremely funny memoirs have sold millions of copies all over the world. And he succeeds as a funny writer on the only index that truly matters. He can make you laugh involuntarily on public transport to the point of embarrassment. And he's done that for me. And just to give you a taste before we chat with David, here he is reading from When You Are Engulfed in Flames.
On the flight to Raleigh, I sneezed, and the cough drop I'd been sucking on shot from my mouth, ricocheted off my folded serving tray, and landed on the lap of the woman beside me, who was asleep and had her arms folded across her chest. I'm surprised the force didn't wake her. That's how hard it hit. But all she did was flutter her eyelids and let out a tiny sigh, the kind you might hear from a baby. Under normal circumstances, I'd have had three choices, the first being to do nothing. The woman would wake in her own time and notice what looked like a shiny new button sewn to the crotch of her jeans. This was a small plane with one seat per row on aisle A and two seats per row on aisle B. We were on B, so should she go searching for answers, I would be the first person on her list. Is this yours, she'd ask? And I'd look dumbly into her lap. Is what mine? Option two was to reach over and pick it off her pants. And number three was to wake her up and turn the table, saying, I'm sorry, but I think you have something that belongs to me. Then she'd hand the lozenge back and maybe even apologize, confused into thinking she'd somehow stolen it in her sleep.
David Sedaris there reading from the story Solution to Saturday's Puzzle, and that's from When You Are Engulfed in Flames. He's with me now. David Sedaris, good morning. Welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. You know, I didn't realize that that was a live version that they put on the book on tape.
Oh, you didn't notice until now, until this?
Well, I cannot get beyond the sound of my own voice. So I had my fingers in my ears during that, but then I heard background laughter, so I realized, because I knew that they had mixed and they had put some live cuts on the book on tape, but I can't listen to myself. But the New Yorker,
really you can't, you find that really difficult, hearing yourself play back like that?
Yeah.
Why?
If I'm in a hotel and I call for room service, they say, we'll have that right up, ma'am. Like, they always think I'm a girl on TV. I mean, on the telephone. Always. So I can't get beyond the sound of my voice. But the New Yorker does an audio version, and, like, you can download it. Someone reads every word of the New Yorker, and they're not actors. They're just, I don't know. It's like they gave the New Yorker to somebody and said, read it. But I like hearing whoever it is read my stories, because then I can actually listen, and I can listen to the story and say, I should change that, or I should do something here or there. But so if somebody else reading it, I'm okay, but not myself.
But you know how it should go. You've written it with those cadences in mind, because it's sort of like putting, I don't know, when you write a story like that, it's a bit like putting it to music in a way, and you know exactly how it ought to be read. It's very pleasurable hearing
it. I know
it.
How it should be, but I have in my mind how it should be read, and the people who read it for The New Yorker don't read it my way, but that's okay, because then I just can focus on the words. But there's a writer named Tobias Wolff, who I revere, and his latest book came out on audio. It was the first audio thing he ever had. And I've read his stories over and over and over, and I have it in my mind exactly how they're supposed to go. And the person who reads them, he does a good job, but it's not the way I know it's supposed to be, and I can't get over that. But somebody reading something I wrote, whatever hell the way they want to, that's fine with me.
Where are you reading that when we're hearing you read that out? Do you know where that was? It could
remember.
Have been anywhere.
I go on these lecture tours in the United States. So come October, I'll go to, I think, 30 cities or 31 cities in 31 days, whatever. So it's a theater somewhere.
Are you beyond stage fright yet?
I usually just get excited unless I don't know the audience. Right, like a couple times, I'm not big on television, but a couple times I've gone on television and there's a live audience and I don't know who those people are. And that makes me a little bit nervous. And once I had to read, I was at a college and I had to read before people who had failed English so many times that they were having to take it over and over and over again. So they were really hostile, stupid people who lived in North Carolina. So that was a hard audience, too. I didn't know who they were.
Well, you just sold out the Sydney Opera House. Obviously, you weren't nervous then? Was that weird? I mean, being in a kind of culture palace like the Sydney Opera House.
It's a little bit different when you're in another country because you don't know how things are going to work. And I had a story that works very well. It's a story I didn't put in the book because on paper it doesn't work. You have to hear it read out loud. And it works in America because Americans are generally so bad when it comes to speaking another language. And I didn't know if Australians were as bad as Americans, and because that's where those laughs come from. But it got a pretty good response.
Coming into the studio today, I didn't have to ask you to turn off your mobile phone because you don't have one.
No.
I recently had a debate with some colleagues about that. A friend sent around an email saying that, I'm just letting you all know my mobile phone, I'm giving it up and I won't be available on that line anymore. And so we had a big, long conversation about it. And he said, no longer will I sort of pay for other people's poor time planning. That was why he was getting rid of it. He didn't, the cost and the fact that the mobile phone allows you to defer decisions to the absolute last minute all the time just means it's just bad time planning and more stress. Is there a similar reason for why you don't have a mobile phone?
You know, I guess I don't have a mobile phone. Did you see that movie, A Mighty Heart?
Yeah.
Angelina Jolie plays, Marianne Pearl, right? And at the beginning of the story, she's in the grocery store in Pakistan, and she calls her husband, and she says, oh, how's your day? And meanwhile, she's shopping. And then later, when her husband gets beheaded, I thought, well, you did talk on a cell phone in the grocery store. Like, that's how unforgiving. Completely unforgiving I am about that. The friends that I know who, you know, they all got phones and then all their manners just, boom, you know, their standards, they left immediately. And then all of a sudden it was okay to talk on the phone while you're in front of the cashier at the grocery store. And all of a sudden it was okay to just make a quick call at the movies. So, and I thought, well, if I get a cell phone, I'll basically the bottom, no one ever calls me.
I'm sure if you got one, they'd be calling you all the time.
But I know what you mean. Like people, if you invite someone to your house for dinner, then 2 minutes before they get there, they call and say, I'm about 2 minutes away. I don't care.
No.
I'm not naked. You know, I'm prepared for them to come. Whenever they want to knock on the door, I'll open it.
There was a at the very first episode of Absolutely Fabulous, the British sitcom, there was a moment where Edina goes into the office, and she's standing there in the entrance office as she's walking in, saying, telling her secretary, I'm coming into the office now. And we used to think that was funny in 1993, but it's something we all do now. How about the computer? Have you managed to stay away from those for a long time, David?
I had a typewriter for the longest time. I was the last person to get a computer, and I have a laptop computer now. But I got the internet. I saw the internet for the first time in, I believe it was September. I saw it.
September.
I saw what it looked like.
Last year. September
yes.
last year.
Yes, I saw what it looked like. I was in the airport and someone showed me what it looked like because I had no idea. I thought it was like a net, like you would stick your net into a rushing river and you would say, oh, look, I pulled out the Denver telephone book. And, oh, look, I pulled out sea turtles, you know, that would – you would just kind of grab at things and hope that you caught them. And then I saw what it looked like, and I looked at the New York Times. Like, my boyfriend set it up so I could read the New York Times. And then I just went on tour, and then I forgot all about it. And then I remembered, like, I don't know, last November, I thought, oh, right, I have that internet. And now I go to bed, and then I lay awake, and then I think, I wonder what Russell Crowe is up to. And then I get up and I go
it's
back
worked.
And I look him up on the interweb. Yeah.
On the interweb.
But I just got I got email in June, beginning of June.
David Sedaris is my guest. You talk about lying in bed there. You relate in one of the stories in the book, When You Are Engulfed in Flames, that you bought your boyfriend Hugh a present, which was a skeleton, a human skeleton, because he sort of hinted, not so subtly, that he wanted one, which is unlike him. And it was his idea to install it in the bedroom, dangling from the ceiling. Is it still there, David?
We moved it from Paris to London. And what was interesting to me, we had it shipped, is it involved no paperwork. I thought that you would have to fill out forms to ship a body from one country to the other. But no, all we needed was a box. And so now it's hanging in his studio in London.
What's the lore on that? Is it when the last bit of flesh disappears from the bones, it just becomes bones? Is there a point you cross where it stops being a person's remains to being merely a skeleton? Then?
Well, this is obviously old, and the head is hinged. You can open it up, right? So, and the teeth and the bones are kind of blackish, and it's pretty clear that it's old.
It's in a story called Memento Mori. You know,
skeleton.
Yeah, you remember, mortal, you are mortal and you must die, and the skeleton seems to whisper that to you. Is that part of being middle-aged now as well, David, that you have those thoughts, that I'm halfway through my life, there's a skeleton in my bedroom saying,
so.
Remember, you must die?
I think having the skeleton there, but I mean, I think if I weren't 51 years old, it wouldn't speak to me quite the way that it does, but... We moved it to Hugh's studio in London, and it was on the second floor of the house there. And then these workmen came, and they were delivering something, and they were carrying the mattress upstairs, and they looked at the skeleton hanging in the studio, and one of them said, "Blimey!" But I love it when I just love it when people say the things you sort of grow up imagining.
When they act out the caricature, yes.
Yeah.
You're waiting for a stranger to say struth to you or crikey at any moment.
Well, you know, like we went to Japan and people say ah so. They really do. And in France, people actually do say ooh la la.
David Sedaris is my guest on The Conversation Hour. His latest book, his latest collection of stories is called When You Are Engulfed in Flames. You're travelling all over the world at the moment. You're on book tours. How do you keep book signings interesting, David Sedaris?
Well, a couple of years ago, I was in Chicago, and I was staying with an old friend. And I said to her, she said, "Do you want to wash your hair before the show or whatever?" And I said, "Oh, no, I just washed it 2 days ago." And she had this look on her face and that suggesting that I was unclean. And, and I said, "What's wrong with that?" And she said, "Everybody washes their hair every day." So I had a show that night, and I thought, well, we'll see about that. So I signed books for hours, and I said to people, "When was the last time you shampooed your hair?" And she was kind of right. Like, everyone did shampoo their hair every day. So sometimes I just have a poll, or I have a question, or I have a medical worry, or...
Really, you say I'm feeling a bit strange or it feels a bit odd. Does anyone... Is that what you ask the queue of people?
Well, okay, like I'm 51, right? So now sometimes I'll urinate and then I'll put everything back. And then I look down and I have urine stains all in front of my pants, right?
The 20-cent piece, my dad.
It's leaking, right? Yes. It's leakage, right? So I started asking men of a certain age if they had the same problem. And one guy said, you need to wear two pairs of underpants. Well, that's what I do. And I thought, oh, my God. And someone else said, you need to urinate sitting down. That's what I do. Someone said, you need to ask your doctor about Flomax. And someone else said, and this is what I would do too. You know, you're at the airport and then you realize you have urine stains on the front of your pants. So you splash yourself to make it look like you just had a sink accident. That's what I do. You get your – so you're at the airport and you're throwing water all over yourself. But I got some tips there.
You don't wear the cream gabardine slacks anymore. That's how you get around it most of the time.
Boy, I'll tell you, that's the first thing. You get rid of those light-colored pants. On this last trip, I asked people – I said, okay, I'm taking a survey. And is Barack Obama circumcised or uncircumcised? And I want you to vote while I sign your book. And what was interesting about that is that these were people who were college-educated people, right? And they would get up there and they would say, well, let's see, I know he's a Muslim. And I know he was born in Africa. And I would say, no, he's a Christian and he was born in Hawaii. Oh, really? I heard. It was shocking how many people said that. So I just kept doing it. I took that poll. Just because if you stood in front of an audience and if you said Barack Obama is not a Muslim and he was born in Hawaii, it would just go in one ear and out the other. But if you said it to people face to face, they would say, oh, really? Oh, gosh, because I heard. I mean, just the amount of misinformation, the depth of misinformation was astonishing to me.
Well, you were born in New York, but you were raised in North Carolina, which is in the South and one of the rebellion states, if you like, part of the Confederacy. It's sometimes said when we sort of view the presidential race from afar that Barack Obama's polling reasonably well, a little bit ahead in the polls at the moment. But it might be a case of Americans, particularly in the South, being prepared to say to an opinion pollster they'll vote for a black man, but when it actually comes to the private act of going into the polling booth, they won't. What's your view on that, some guy from the South?
I guess my feeling is that so many towns in America have a black mayor. And usually if there's any politician you're going to lay your eyes on, it's your mayor. Like most people have never seen the president in person or their governor in person. So I don't think it's that much of a stretch. I really don't. Also, I think if you had to say, I don't know, I mean there's a big difference between Barack Obama and like Al Sharpton in most people's minds. I mean I think that's one of the reasons why the Republicans keep trying to goad Barack Obama so they can say he's an angry black man. And he does like everything he can to remain calm and remain unangry, because the second that they can use that they will. To me personally, if I had to say what is the number one thing Barack Obama is, I would say he's good looking, you know, or he's articulate. I mean, black would be on – I mean, he's half white. So he's – that would be like on the list, like, I don't know, third on my list. But again, you know, a lot of people would put it maybe number one. But I don't think that I think he's going to win.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
I noticed reading in the book you recount a story of nagging your boyfriend Hugh to go to Taronga Park Zoo in Sydney because you wanted to see a dingo. And I have to say, as I read that, I felt this increasing sense of dread because dingoes are beautiful creatures. You know, they're beautiful, but they're perhaps the least eccentric of Australia's native fauna, you know, compared to emus or a platypus or a kangaroo or something like that. What did you think a dingo was?
I had absolutely no idea. And it really is true. If somebody said, oh, a dingo, you got to keep your windows closed at night or dingoes will fly in. Or if somebody said, we used to have a pond in our backyard and it got completely overrun by dingoes. I had absolutely no idea what a dingo was. No idea whatsoever. And they're basically dogs.
Yeah, cute dogs.
I was shocked when I went to the zoo and saw what they were. And I guess they had pictures of them. I'd seen pictures of them. But, you know, when you see pictures of Australian wildlife, but they weren't labeled. And I thought, oh, look, there's a dog looking at some wildlife. It didn't occur to me that that's what the dingo was.
The cover of the book has got a lovely image of a skeleton with a cigarette in its mouth, and the most important stories in the book is about you giving up smoking. That decision to give up smoking, all that harassment that's inflicted on smokers these days, you know, stand outside, stand well away from the building, the ostracization, it actually worked on you, didn't it? That actually worked.
Well, what worked for me was I go on these lecture tours, right, twice a year, some 60 nights a year at least I'm in a hotel. And all the decent hotels in America went non-smoking. So I can go to 30 cities in 30 days if I'm at the Four Seasons or the Ritz-Carlton. But when you put me at that hotel out on the highway, that's one next to the muffler shop, where the lobby smells like chlorine, but there's not a pool, I can't do it. And I finally had to say, okay. You win.
It's luxury hotels or cigarettes, and the luxury hotels went out. There's another list. It sounds like you were sick of smoking because there's a lovely and vivid description of what a nicotine hangover feels like, where you say you wake up in the morning with, you see, my tongue feeling like some filthy sandal stuffed into my mouth. Were you sick of it?
No, I wasn't. I really enjoyed smoking, and I smoked for, 30 years, and I smoked with gusto. And often, you know, sometimes hotels would say, you can go outside and smoke. And I would say, you don't understand. That's not what a smoker is. Like, a smoker doesn't turn it on and off. I would have to move my bed outside and my desk outside. Because when I travel, I try to work. But to me, working was all caught up with smoking. So I couldn't sit at my computer or whatever for an hour and then say, oh, I should go outside and have a cigarette now. The two went together. So, and I'd never considered quitting. I never thought about it. And again, the hotels were the only reason. If I found out tomorrow that I had cancer, first thing I'd do is start smoking again.
You decided to give up in Japan. Why Japan?
Well, I went to Japan for 3 days, and I loved it, absolutely loved it. But Hugh and I arrived, and we arrived at Tokyo Station, and we were walking to our hotel. And first thing I did was light a cigarette when we left the train station. And then I looked around, and there were thousands of people on the sidewalk, and none of them were smoking. Right? So I was going to crush my cigarette, and then I looked, and I didn't see any. I saw no trash cans, and I saw no trash. So I crushed the cigarette, and then I put the butt in my pant cuff, right? And then I saw a cigarette butt with a slash through it on the sidewalk. And in Tokyo, because so many people were getting burned by lit cigarettes, you have to go to an outdoor smoking station.
And then how are they getting burnt by lit cigarettes?
Because there's great crowds. And so let's say 1,000 people gather on the street corner to cross the street. They've all got a cigarette in their hand. And there were little signs, like one of the signs said, a lit cigarette is held at the height of a child's eye. And it had a little drawing of a child with a cigarette butt sticking out of her eye hole.
There was a drawing of that, a drawing of the butt.
Yes.
So the language is polite, but the images are something else.
Well, another sign said, when I pass gas, I look behind me. But when I smoke, I don't bother. But most of the signs were about being a good neighbor, right? They weren't health related. Like the warnings on cigarettes say, be careful of how much you smoke so as not to damage your health. Right? Like in France, it says smoking will kill you, and you can read the letters from space. But in Japan, it's just very like, so.
So you were beguiled by the charming language of Japanese warning signs.
Well, also, okay, so if you couldn't smoke outside, so But then inside, you can smoke your head off. So it's just the opposite of everywhere else. So if you go to an office or a restaurant or a coffee shop, they're filled with smoke. So, and sometimes when you quit, you need to be around a lot of smoke. So this was fantastic. So when I needed a cigarette, I could just go into a coffee shop and be around other people's cigarettes. And it was actually another reason that I quit, went to Tokyo to quit, was generally when the telephone rings, I light a cigarette, right? But the time difference between France and Japan is so profound. Like, it's August in Japan, but it's next August. You know what I mean? Like, I figured no one would ever call me. They would never be able to figure out the time difference. And my phone rang four times.
And that's it?
While I was there.
And you were thus able to give up smoking after, a couple of weeks? Or how long? How long did it take?
Well, I had my last cigarette at Charles de Gaulle Airport. I got on the airplane. I went to Tokyo, and I haven't had a cigarette since then.
No cravings? Bad cravings? Did you get any of that?
Oh, yeah, but I didn't smoke.
You just lived through it. Yeah. And being you needed to isolate yourself from your friends in order to do it. David Sedaris here with a novel anti-smoking therapy. Go to Japan for a while if you want to quit smoking.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
My guest today is American writer David Sedaris, whose latest book is called When You Are Engulfed in Flames. David, you famously keep a notebook in your pocket, and you've pulled it out quite a few times in the hour or so you've been here to take notes. You have this at hand all the time, this
yes.
notebook?
I always keep it in my pocket and just write down, I don't know, like I had never heard the producer for your show was angry, and she said, "Flaming heck," which just was funny to me. And then she said, "Flaming Nora." I'd never heard that before. Queenslander. I had never heard that phrase before. Because we saw those houses when we were coming in.
So you just take notes. And does this get uploaded to your diary tonight? Some of the stuff? Or do you try and make it part of a coherent whole every day when you write in your diary?
I get up in the morning, and I write things in my diary. So I'll write things down all day, and then I'll have a lead story. Like, my lead story this morning, I went to the pool when I was in Sydney, and it was twice as long as the swimming pool that I go to in London. I mean, it's a really super long pool, and those people, I've never seen such hardy swimmers ever, and they really followed the rules, you know? Like when you go to the pool in France, there'll be a line that says fast lane, right, for people doing the crawl. And then women get in there with glasses on. Like, I don't mean – not goggles. I mean, they have their glasses on, right? And they get two by two, and they do the side stroke so they can talk. And that's not what the sign says. Or, you know, like everywhere else in the world, you swim from one end to the other. And in France, when you go to the pool, people say, I want to swim side to side. Or, I want to dive. Like, the rules are not for them. The rules are for everybody but for them. And I just was so impressed by that swimming pool.
Yeah, I don't know if that's an Anglo-Saxon thing, or I don't know what it is, but we were talking before you went on air about how in Paris, it's the most wonderful place, it's the most beautiful place, but people don't believe in queuing there, and people will jump a queue all the time, and you rage, don't you? You feel that palpable sense of rage when a woman cuts in ahead of you in a queue in Paris.
Well, I do. Like, I notice that. You'll go to the movies, and someone will be behind you, and then they're next to you, and then they're in front of you. Or I love watching people cut in line, too, and I like that, the look on their face while they're doing it. Another thing I notice in Paris is that you see there are a lot of women who have had a lot of cosmetic surgery, right? So they want to look 40, but then when they get on the bus, then they're 75 again, and they want your seat. And they ask you for your seat. And I'm always thinking, you know, you have fishnets on. You have fishnet stockings on. I have more lines in my face than you do. It's my seat.
So if you're... if you're 70 and you have plastic surgery and wear fishnets, you forfeit the right to seat on public transport.
I think you should. I think you should.
You said you were in France once, and at a woman at the supermarket, a woman got ahead in the queue. She jumped the queue. Tell me what happened there, David.
Well, that was a situation where I would say nothing, right? I mean, I would be very angry and would have horribly wicked thoughts, but I'd be afraid to say anything, in part because I would be sure that I was going to say it wrong. And you know how it is when you're somewhere and then a foreigner like wants to complain, and then you think, oh, just go home. That's what people think. Oh, just go home. You know, if you can't even complain, white, go home. So I don't say anything because I'm afraid I might say it wrong. Plus, I'm just timid, right? But this man behind me said, oh, no, there's a line. You jumped the line. And the woman said, well, I'm in a hurry. And he said, we're all in a hurry. She said, well, I'm here, tough. And she started putting her things on the belt, and this man started just taking her things right off the belt and putting them back in her cart. So she'd take something from her cart, put it on the belt. He would put it back, and then we were just there. Like this could have gone on for years. But it was so pleasurable watching someone defy her.
It's a bit of social theatre that's enacted right before your eyes and allows you to sort of stay within your own cowardice. I enjoy that sort of thing enormously. I will never say anything either.
Well, we went to southern Italy, and we were in southern Italy, and it's completely different than northern Italy. But we were I was at the grocery store, and there people – it's just they have to cut in front of you. They can't live until they cut in front of you, right? So I thought, no one's going to cut in front of me this time. And I was pressed right against the woman in front of me. This other woman went all the way around to the other side of the register and started handing her items directly to the cashier. That's how much it meant to her to cut in front of me.
Well, that goes beyond queue cutting. That's something else altogether, isn't it? That's such a naked bit of social aggression. You have to sort of really applaud it, really. I mean, it goes beyond just suddenly pushing in, isn't it? You have this diary you famously draw upon. Do you feel like you work for your diary? I mean, your diary is something that says, you know, get to work every day for you.
It does. I mean, sometimes I can just write something in my diary and then I transcribe it and then I think, oh, why did I even bother? I don't even care about that. You know, I'm just doing it because it's a way to warm up before I move on and write other things. But then sometimes nothing much can happen, but I can just be in the proper mood and I can write about it in my diary and I can think, oh, I bet I can use that someday. Like, that's actually, you know, what I'm writing about is nothing in the great scheme of things, but maybe I can use it. And even on my book tour, you know, on the book tour, I'm out in the world and I'm seeing so much and I'm exposed to so much and I'm meeting hundreds and hundreds of people a day. But then it can just be something surprising that sticks in my mind. Like, oh, I was on my book tour in the United States and, you know, so I had interviews and, I signed books the night before for like, I don't know, something crazy, like 8 hours or something. But then I saw a man and a fellow with Down syndrome on the plane, and he was sitting next to an older man, and he was very well groomed, you know, like someone was taking really good care of this guy, and the shades were down on the plane, and I thought that maybe he would put the shades up because he wanted to look at the other planes, but he was so profoundly retarded that it didn't really matter to him if they were up or not. Anyway, just the relationship between these two men, and they didn't say anything to each other, and the guy had a Coke during the flight. But anyway, I was just so caught up in them, and then wondering what was going to go on with them at the baggage claim, and then this third person joined them at the baggage claim. Anyway, it was just this little thing, and it was just, but it was more compelling to me than anything that had happened that day, and I just wanted to know more about, like, I wanted to know everything about these people who said nothing to me. So sometimes it's just something small like that. And days later, you're still thinking about it. And it's
got a kind of hidden poetry in it, behind it, that you sort of peek at through a keyhole almost.
Right, but it can be, like I said, it doesn't have to be any big thing. It can just be some small moment and time just sort of stops. And you remember the pleasure of being curious.
Diaries can be dangerous things, David Sedaris. You know, Tolstoy famously, on his wedding night, I think it was, showed his diaries, which were voluminous and pretty exhaustive, showed them to his bride, It was Sonia or Katja, I can't quite remember her name, but she was utterly, utterly shocked and freaked out because they recounted his visits to brothels and other places of ill repute that a Russian aristocrat wouldn't imagine them going to. And she was shocked and never quite got over that shock. Have any of your partners ever seen your diaries?
You know, the boyfriend that I was with before I met Hugh, I was out of town and he read one of my diaries, right? And he was very, very angry because he wasn't in there. And that's what so angered him. But he wasn't, and he's right, you know, he wasn't in there. I guess.
That surprised you?
When he was angry about that, I thought, oh, surely he's wrong. But then I looked through. I looked through, and he was right. He wasn't in there. And it was really a pretty good reflection of how he was in my life, you know, like, and I thought, oh. But I've never given my diary to anybody. Like, I've never, and I would be incredibly uncomfortable if anyone were to ever read it.
Has Hugh got the good sense not to read it?
Or yes, does he read it? He doesn't. My diaries are pretty. You know, like, now I print them out, but I used to type them on sheets of paper that are 8 by 9.5 inches long, and then I make covers, and then I have them bound, right? With this spiral binding, and now it's like a metal binding as opposed to a plastic one. And I used to make the covers myself, or sometimes I might find like a, you know, someone might have a sign that says, I need money bad, and I would think, wow, you know, that's a great diary cover. So, you know, buy it from him and use that to make the cover, cut it down to 8 by 9.5 inches.
So is there a bookshelf in your home somewhere or which has got rows and rows and rows of these beautifully made diaries?
Yes.
And do you feel...
it's a cabinet. You know,
it's
with a
cabinet?
Lock on it, yeah.
And do you then feel... It must be... I'm just guessing that I imagine the pleasure of watching it get a bit bigger and a bit bigger. The way writers often talk about, you know, you put out another book and you watch that little wodge on the bookshelf of one's own book slightly get a little bit longer. Is that immensely satisfying, watching that row of diaries just get a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger?
It's satisfying when I think about, like I said, the covers. Hugh is a painter. I went to art school, but I don't have any talent that way whatsoever, right? But Hugh is actually a very talented painter. So there are these spiders that I feed in Normandy who live in our house in Normandy. They're called Tegenaria gigantea. So I found
a photograph. I don't like the gigantea. I don't like that part of the name.
Well, I found someone gave me a book on spiders, and it had a really beautiful photograph of Tegenaria. And I said to Hugh, will you paint this for me for my summer diary cover? So he said, oh, sure. So he painted it. So that cover, when I bind my summer diary, you know, in early October, that cover is going to be really beautiful. So when I look at that case, I think of all these really nice paintings that I have. I think of that more than what's inside the book. Because again, you know, if every day I write a page or two in this diary, maybe there's 10 pages out of that whole thick book that are worth anything. And the rest of it is just garbage. But,
yeah, but
that's
just
what
for
a diary
you.
Should be.
Exactly.
Right.
It's for you. It's not for anyone else. The books are for your readers, but the diaries are just for you. I read something where you once said that none of this really exists until I write it down. And that really brought to mind that lovely moment in Through the Looking Glass, the Lewis Carroll book, where Tweedledum and Tweedledee tell Alice to be quiet because the Red King is asleep under the tree. And if they wake up the Red King, it'll be a disaster because... He says, we're all part of the Red King's dream. You're just a thing in his dream. And if he wakes up, poof, you go out just like a candle. That's what that makes me think of. Do you really feel that the life isn't lived unless it's recorded?
I suppose so. Or it helps me put things into perspective. Sometimes if I'm angry, let's say I'm angry about something, then I write it down in my diary and then I read it over and I think, boy, you are such a baby. Like, you care about that? So it can help me that way. It can help put things into perspective, or it can just help me get things off my chest. Or I guess I just get nervous because it's not recorded. Like when I see people like in Paris walking around Paris, and I see people with cameras and they take pictures of like absolutely everything. I think, oh, must you? Like, what would happen if you didn't take a picture of that stupid pyramid outside the Louvre? Like, what would happen if you didn't have a picture of that? But I'm just the same way, except I don't have a camera. But, you know, it's the same. It's the same, I suppose. I always notice that in France, though, that people only take pictures of things that they've seen pictures of. Right? Like if that glass pyramid at the Louvre was in no book, then no one would ever think to take a picture of it. Because I actually think I could make that.
That's doing my head in, that thought. And I wonder what that's all about, too. We've seen it in picture. We've gone to see it in life. Now we must prove it's real to ourselves. Like, we were there. It does exist. It isn't just a picture in a book.
Well, so other people have their, you know, other people do the same thing. Like, they need a picture of it in order to make it real. So, and I'm the same.
Success for you as a writer came, well, I don't know, reasonably late in life. I know, in your 30s, I think you were, weren't you, when you began to read the Santaland Diaries on National Public Radio in the United States, and you'd been through a whole lot of different jobs there. Just tell me what that was like for you, first of all, and what you were doing at the time for a living when you read your Santaland Diaries on National Public Radio.
Well, I used to live in Chicago, and then I moved to New York just because, I don't know, I always wanted to live there, so... And when I left Chicago, I was teaching at the Art Institute. I had no business teaching, but they hired me to teach writing, right? I only went to undergraduate school. So I was a teacher. And then I moved to New York, and I got a job as an elf at Santaland. That was the only job I could find because I'm small, right? So they hired
me. Did you get talent scouted for that? Is it like being a supermodel? You're waiting at a bus, and someone goes, "You're our elf." Is that what happens?
Well, I went. There was an ad in the paper, so I went to Macy's, and like there were dwarfs there, and I thought, damn, you know, I'd be so mad if that dwarf gets my job. but I figured if you were small and cheerful, you know, that was half of it right there. And it was. And so I got hired, and I actually did that for 2 years.
2 years. Did any of your students see you doing it? Were you worried that
lived in Chicago.
Oh, okay. So it's a different thing. This is in New York. Okay.
Then I worked when it wasn't Christmas time. I got a job at a house cleaning. I worked as a maid. So I had regular people who I would go and I would clean their houses. And I would go home at night and write. But that always seemed normal to me. Like, I never was one of those people who thought, you know, I should be able to write like all day, damn it. Because you're only going to be good for like 3 hours, or me anyway, and you got to do something with the rest of your day. And it was good work, you know. It paid pretty well, and it got me all over town. And you know, what could be better? You go into someone's house, you go through all their stuff. it was perfect. Perfect work for me. It really was.
Having actually then read the diaries, which was a big deal in the United States, on the very straight-laced NPR, I mean, we get that here on News Radio, on ABC News Radio, and, you know, we get All Things Considered, which sounds kind of straight-laced and proper. You're reading these enormously funny and bawdy diaries. What was that like for you to suddenly get this big, big response to having read the Santaland Diaries about your experiences as a Macy's elf on air?
Well, I'd been reading out loud when I lived in Chicago and when I first moved to New York, but I think probably the most people I'd ever read out loud in front of. There was a place in Chicago that had maybe 300 people, but that was as part of a variety show, right? But there were 10 million people who listened to this program that I was on in the United States, on Morning Edition, right? I'd never listened to Morning Edition. I listened to All Things Considered, but a part of leading a good life, I thought, was being asleep when Morning Edition was on, because it came on, I don't know, like 6 o'clock until 7:30 in the morning or something. Anyway, they broadcast my story on Morning Edition, and literally my phone just, the second it ended, my phone started ringing. Would you like to fly to Los Angeles? We want you to audition for a movie with Jack Nicholson. We want you to write for the Seinfeld. Do you have a book we can publish? This is Harper's Magazine. We'd love to reprint what you just read on the radio. I mean, it was like my fantasy. It was like opportunity, right? Came a calling. And I think...
Came stampeding, in fact.
Well, I think it helped that I was 35 at that time, that I could say, well, that's really nice, but I'm not an actor. And auditioning for a movie with Jack Nicholson is actually not going to do anything for me in any way. I'm certainly not going to get the part. I can't. It's not even the kind of thing you can write about, because it just seems kind of snarky. Writing for television, don't really want to do it. Soap operas called and said, "Can you write?" And I love soap operas, right? So that was like, but they wanted me to write for this soap opera that was like really kind of a minor. It was called Loving. And
but if Bold and the Beautiful had come knocking, you would have been there maybe.
Well, One Life to Live. But I think it helped that I thought, okay, well, I know what I always wanted to write for The New Yorker. And I always wanted to have a book. And, you know, in terms of doing the voiceover, like, no, forget it. You know, I'm not even going to consider that. And I'm forget this and forget that. But it was like someone came along with a wand. And choof, just everything I had dreamt of made it happen.
Reading the new collection of stories, there's a kind of an underlying theme that I think you're sort of hinting at, because it's, I suspect you find it a bit kind of mawkish to actually come out and say it, but you seem to be happy in this book, and you seem to be thankful as well, reading that. You sort of, there's quiet little thank yous throughout the book for your life, because now you live well, you live in, you know, places in Paris and in London as well. You've made a lot of money, you're successful, you're acknowledged, you're popular and all those things, and you're in a very happy relationship, all those things. That's true, isn't it? Would you dare to come out and actually say, my life's really lovely right now, and I'm actually quite happy with it. Is that true?
Oh, yes. Oh, no, it really is. But at the same time, you know, I had to worry about, with this book, I had to worry, like, there's a story, the first time I was flown first class in an airplane, right? And I'm thinking, oh, this is what that's all about, you know, like, and look, they keep bringing me the stuff. And the flight attendant came and said, oh, do you mind if we move somebody here, you know, sitting, you know, the seat next to you is empty. Do you mind if we fill it? There's a man a few rows up, and his crying is disturbing the people around him. And it was a man who's a Polish man whose mother had just died, and he was on his way to a funeral. So it was like they took a storm cloud and parked the storm cloud next to me on the plane, right? But I thought, okay, our reader's going to say, well, like, what the hell with you? You know, I never get to ride first class in an airplane, and so what do you have to complain about?
So, I just can't imagine what it's like for a flight attendant to say, I'm sorry, there's someone back here who's crying uncontrollably. Can we put him next to you?
Well, the person he was sitting next to before complained, okay, which can you imagine, like, complaining because the man next to you is crying? But that's what he did.
Did you talk to him?
Well, because his mother died and he was on his way to the funeral. That's what the flight attendant told me. So I just had this storm cloud next to me on the seat the whole time. But you know, just in writing a thing like that, I had to worry that people were going to say, well, you know, I never get to ride in first class. Like, so what are you complaining about? Or I never get to stay in nice hotels. But I'm still me, right? I mean, I'm still the same person. And I still have all the doubts that I ever had as well. You know, like
you've sold 7 million books.
Yourself that you sold. You know, like you're on the bestseller list, right? So you think, oh my goodness, I'm on the bestseller. You know, I'm on the New York Times bestseller list. Well, who's under me? Tori Spelling. Okay. So it's kind of hard to tell yourself that the New York Times bestseller list is about quality. And then I got knocked off because these Swift boat people wrote a book, did a trashy book about
John Kerry,
Barack Obama.
Oh, Barack Obama. Oh,
the same people who did it to him. They did it. Yeah. So now they're number one. So what I was going to tell myself, I was telling myself that the number one slot on the New York Times bestseller list, bespoke quality. So, you know, you can still tell yourself horrible things. It doesn't really matter. You know, if your books do well, then you think of a better writer whose books don't sell, and then you just sort of feel guilty and ashamed.
Do you wait for that moment that a lot of very successful people worry about, which is the moment when some guy in a suit and a hat will knock at your door, you open the door, he'll walk in and say, you've done very well, David Starris. You pulled the wool over our eyes for a very long time. It's over now. Thank you very much. No more of your books. No more of your writing. You've fooled us for long enough. That's it. It's all over. Do you have that kind of strange fantasy of someone walking into your life and saying, yes, you've been found out. This is all a ruse.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, and the people that I know, like I have that It's like a recent immigrant's idea of money too. Like must hide it because someone's going to come and demand it all. You know, they're going to say that a horrible mistake's been made and we gave you all this money and we need to have it back now. But no, I wait. I do. There'll come a time when a book will come out and people will say, didn't we tell him to go away? And I'll go on a lecture tour and nobody will show up. But in the meantime, like, I really do enjoy it. You know, I really, like, I'm the only person I know who loves a book tour. Love going on a book tour.
That's why the skeleton in your bedroom was a good thing. That's why, you know, Memento Mori, that was the original Memento Mori, you know, was the slave that whispered in the victorious Roman general's ear, you know, remember all things are passing and you are mortal and all those things. And that would increase the pleasure for the general. That's you're reminding yourself of your good fortune all the time. Is that what it is?
Maybe that has to do with keeping a diary. Is it if I want to remember what it was like not to have these things, all I have to do is open that cabinet and I can read exactly what it was like. And I can read what it was like to so actively dream, you know, of having a book, you know, just one. And when you said, you know, you put the book on the shelf and you say, oh my goodness, look how much space I'm taking up now. You know, I guess there's a point when, yeah, that's the first thing I do is like, they send me a new book and I go and I put it on the pile and I...
And you go, yes.
Yeah.
David Sedaris is my guest on The Conversation Hour. Recently, of course, David, there was the article in The New Republic which accused you of, as a humorist, of chronic exaggeration. Then other writers in the Washington Post came to your defense and saying, well, if this is a crime, then we better arrest Mark Twain, James Thurber, and Bill Cosby as well. I don't know. When I read that, I worry about, you know, I suppose you have to be put in the non-fiction category. I'd rather you be put in the fiction and the humor category on the bookshelf. I would say reading this, and I'm sure you'd agree, that there's a kind of jester's license for humor that allows you to exaggerate. That's the point of it, because it's like putting an incident to music. Is that how you'd say it?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think when somebody tells me something and when I read something and it's funny, I don't know. There are two kinds. You know, there's a kind of person someone will tell me a story and I'm the kind of person who is going to laugh at that story or not laugh at that story, but I'm not going to say, that's not true. Like, it doesn't really, that's not what really matters. And I suppose that I suspect there's a degree of manipulation in the things that do make me laugh, but I don't concentrate on that. I just enjoy the laughing.
No, you've had to work as a journalist occasionally, and for a piece on the Esquire magazine about visiting a morgue. Was that painful to actually have to be a journalist and actually have to stick to the facts?
That was the only time in my life I've ever done that, and I had a tape recorder with me and a photographer came, and it gave me like a great respect for journalists, and it made me realize how absolutely hard what they do is.
David Sedaris, it's been absolutely pleasurable. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.